Hello. Oh my goodness, was the traffic that bad? Yes, I think it was. It's a huge pleasure to introduce a second talk in this kind of series of talks under the kind of umbrella of what we've been calling radical theology. If any of you were at Peter Olin's talk just now, you'll have heard one of the kind of his particular Irish take on that. And then after John's talk, Catherine Sarah Moody is going to be doing a talk kind of critiquing both John and Pete's work up in Bethany at 7:30. It's with enormous pleasure that I'd like to welcome John Caputo to Greenbelt for the first time. I can't believe it's taken us this long to get round to inviting him. He is, he's taught in both the philosophy and the religion departments of various American universities. He's a professor of philosophy of religion. And an extremely wonderful man. Now retired, he's committed to kind of helping churches and organizations work out what his academic work may mean in practice. So it is with huge pleasure I would like you to give an enormous Greenbelt welcome to actually the big JC.
Thank you, Castor, and thank you to the organizers of Greenbelt for this invitation. Having spent my life as a professional philosopher in an academic world, I have not been invited to many festivals before. The American Philosophical Association does not run festivals. But it looks like a lot of fun, and I'm glad to be here, and maybe it's possible to have some fun with what in a more sober environment we would call philosophy of religion, but in this environment we're going to call radical theology. And so let's see if we can do this. I'm going to organize this around the concept of, or the quasi-concept of, perhaps. And so, if this were an academic paper, I would say my thesis is that radical theology is a theology of perhaps, or radical theology is a theology of God, perhaps. And if you'd like a book with that title, we'll have a salesperson in the back of the tent. All right. Now, first, I'll begin with two quotes. I will be academic enough, if you will permit me, to read two quotes to you. The first, perhaps, one must always say perhaps for God. There is a future for God, and there is no God except to the degree that some event is possible which, as event, exceeds calculations, rules, programs, anticipations. God, as the experience of absolute alterity, is unpresentable. But God is the chance of the event and the chance of history. End quote. Now, you have been listening to Jacques Derrida. Well, you've been listening to his voice. He says he died about 10 years ago, and he said, "I'm smiling at you wherever I am." With one minor exception, every time I said God, he didn't say God. He said something else. And if you really care to know, I may tell you. If you really, really care to know, you'll have to buy the book. Second quote. You might find this one more familiar. "See, I am sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be as wise as serpents and innocent as doves. That's a really weird thing to say, isn't it? Innocent as doves, wise as serpents, sheep among wolves. Three different theo-zoological figures. How weird is that statement? That statement is so weird that the Jesus Seminar thinks he may actually have said it. Now, here's what I want to do. I want to present two orders or regimes of the word perhaps. The word perhaps is a very interesting word. It's an adverb, and its function is to modify, deflect, interrupt, modalize, or in some way or another, rechannel. A noun or a verb. Directly a verb. So first I want to present the grammar of perhaps. And then I want to present the eccentric grammar of perhaps, the weird grammar of perhaps, one that will maybe fit together with this text from Matthew and from Jacques Derrida. And then, having introduced this other possibility for perhaps, I want to talk about God, perhaps. Okay? So perhaps straightforwardly, perhaps in a more eccentric way, God, perhaps. Okay? Perhaps in its ordinary sense is a word that it's not what we want from philosophy and theology, right? Theology wants certitude and salvation. Philosophers want good arguments and decisions. Perhaps seems to be the opposite. Perhaps seems to be a sheer evasion. So, where we want decision, perhaps suggests indecision. Where we want judgment, perhaps means the suspension of judgment. Where religion and theology want faith, perhaps means doubt. Being of little faith. Where decision and choice require courage, perhaps is timid and fearful of decisions. We want things to be definite, perhaps is indefinite and obscure. We want to be resolute, perhaps is irresolute. We want precision, perhaps is vague and indefinite. We want knowledge, perhaps is skepticism. Agnosticism, when you say to someone, do you believe in God or do you not believe in God? Do you believe in God or do you believe God exists? Or do you believe God does not exist? You say, well, we know, maybe, I don't know, perhaps. So it's the soul of timidity and agnosticism. We want things to be risky, and perhaps is cowardly and plays it safe. We want a positive position, and faith either affirmative or negative. Perhaps is neutral. Nay, uter, neither one nor the other. We want to deal with reality and actuality. Perhaps is just like daydreaming. We want to be responsible. Perhaps is irresponsible. We want a definite cut between what is and what is not. Perhaps says, you know, maybe, could be, who knows? perhaps gives us images and dissemblances and copies and hazards a guess and doesn't know. Now, all of that, that body of binaries, of binary oppositions, two-parted oppositions, all of that is what, in a more technical manner, if this were the American Philosophical Association, we would call the metaphysics of presence, where things either are or they are not. And things are either true or false. And perhaps is evasive. This is the order of being, the order of logic, the order of ontologic, the metaphysics of presence, where everything is either present or absent. All right, now, that would be all there is to perhaps. We could say perhaps that's all there is to perhaps. Maybe, unless there's another order of perhaps, a more extraordinary order. Instead of a grammar, this man Jacques Derrida would say a grammatology, where things are not so strong, sharply opposite and divided, but weaker. So we could even entertain the idea of weak thought. There's an important postmodern philosopher named Gianni Vattimo. Italian philosophers, I always recommend Italian philosophers. Gianni, it was a joke. Caputo, Vattimo. Vattimo speaks about pensiero diabolo, not devilish thought, but weak thought. An order, perhaps there is another order where things are not so cut and dry, not so sharp, not so strongly divided, not reducible to presence and absence. Not the order of being and not being, or metaphysics, or logic, or ontologic. Not that. But another kind of perhaps. And let's say, just for the sake of the discussion, we'll call that other order the order of the event. The event, not like Greenbelt is an event. But if someday Greenbelt produces a transformation in someone's life that is unforeseeable at this moment, if some speaker says something to you or somebody in the crowd at one of the food tents says something to you that changes your life, only you don't realize that it happens a month from now or a year from now. That's the event. The event is like that. So Derrida calls it a specter, a shadowy, haunting figure. And so instead of an ontology of presence and absence, a hauntology of specters and shadows. And that's not my... They told me not to do that. They said, don't beat your breast. And I said, I am not a Calvinist. I do not beat my breast. That's not my pun, that is actually Jacques Derrida's pun. One of the things I like about him is that he's funny. He introduces laughter into things that are deadly serious. Deadly, emphasizing deadly, because we are all mortal and headed for what appears to be oblivion. And he maintains humor in the face of that mortality. This vita mortalis, Augustine called it. It's mortal life. So Derrida calls this thing a specter. Jesus calls it the kingdom of God. What's to come? What's something coming? Something to come, something we can't see coming, something unforeseeable, something that will be risky as a sheep among wolves, wise as a serpent, that is, know how to negotiate the roundabouts of life. We, having spent the afternoon getting lost on one roundabout after another and almost not making it here. And innocent like a dove, that is a weak kind of thinking. What's the event? The event is not what happens, but what's going on in what happens, and it's marked by this characteristic of the to come. What's coming? But what's coming, not in the sense that you can foresee it, like you know what's next on the schedule, or you know what's going to happen tomorrow, or you have an appointment next week. Not the foreseeable future, which you should be able to foresee as best you can, and you should try, and you should plan for it. I'm not trying to downplay it. But the unforeseeable future, the thing that takes you by storm, that blindsides you, that takes you by surprise. The unforeseeable future, which is structurally unforeseeable. It's unforeseeable because it's unpredictable, it's unprogrammable. If you remember that original quote where he says, God, if there would be something like that, would be something that you couldn't predict, foresee, or program. You couldn't run a program that will generate this result. This result is unprogrammable, unforeseeable. It's what may happen to us in the next moment or the next day that will change everything. Or maybe it'll just change some things. The unforeseeable, and that absolute surprise, can't be an absolute surprise, but let's say that for rhetorical value. Can't be an absolute surprise because you have to have a horizon of expectation in order to be surprised. If you didn't have a horizon of expectation, nothing would surprise you. Life would just be pure chaos. So a surprise is not pure chaos. It's a contextual bit of chaotic happening. It's an event. And we can also call it the impossible. Not simply impossible, because if it was simply impossible, it wouldn't happen. But the impossible. The sort of thing that when it happens, we say, how did that happen? It's not possible. How did that happen? For better or for worse? A phone call that changes everything, changes your whole life. For better or for worse? It always has to do with what's to come, but it simultaneously is plugged into what has been all along. We are always trying to remember something from time immemorial. So that in just the way the radical future, this is why we're calling it radical theology, because it has to do with a radical future. It also has to do with a radical past. The radical future is a future I can't see coming. The radical past is a past that belongs to time immemorial, that is receded from view in principle, like the unconscious would be that way. If something happened to you and you repressed it in the unconscious, it would belong to an immemorial. But it would constitute us. It would still be part of us. So we're always trying to remember something that we can't remember and foresee something that we can't see coming. And that's what we're trying to see, which we can't see coming, is linked to what we have been all along, but we can't quite recall. And that future past belongs to the present. How? As a ghost, as a simmering possibility, as a something that makes the present tremble with instability. So that when something good happens to us, we fear we're going to lose it, and when something bad happens to us, we hope we're going to get out of this mess. The present is always inwardly destabilized by the event. The present harbors something unforeseeable and immemorial, like the dream that we have of a, let's say, a democracy to come, a radical democracy, which we dream of. So the event has to do with dreaming. It's not what happens. It's what's going on in what happens. In the language of philosophy, we would say the present is always deconstructible. You've heard this word deconstruction, I'm sure. It's always used in popular discourse to mean break something down, knock it down, criticize it. That's only a small part of it, a preliminary part of it. That kind of critical analysis is only a preliminary part. When something is deconstructible, what we're trying to do is release its future. Release this unforeseeable future. Because the more we program our lives, the more we prevent this event. Present is deconstructible in the name of what we are dreaming of, what we desire with a desire beyond desire, because the desires that we're conscious of don't have to do with the event. It's the desire beyond desire. So that if someone says to you, "What do you want? What do you want from religion or God or politics? What do you desire?" The real answer should be, on this account, something I know not what. Because it belongs to this unforeseeable future that is the wellspring of hope and fear, both. Because you can't have one, you can't have hope without fear, you can't have fear without hope, because you can only hope for something that you fear for being lost. And you can only fear what you hope will not be held back from you. Hope and fear belong together. It raises very serious problems, I think insurmountable problems, for the classical theological concept of life beyond or outside time. I think that's incoherent. But that's another. That's something else. Okay, now, what then, given what we just said about the event, what would it mean to say, perhaps, in this other order, not the order of presence, but the order of the event? Not the order of what is, but the order of what is structurally to come. And it's very beautiful, this central concept in deconstruction, and this kind of philosophy that I'm interested in, I think dovetails perfectly with the notion of the kingdom to come. Even though the author of deconstruction was an atheist. But he was a Jewish atheist, which means he had a sort of messianic thing going on in his head, whether he knew it or not. He grew up in a Jewish family. So there was a kind of ancient memory of the Messiah, no matter how old he got. As a matter of fact, the older he got, the more messianic he got. Okay, so what does perhaps look like in this other order? Well, when I say perhaps, and I'm thinking of the event, then that's not despair. That's hope. It's hope in a promise which may not be kept. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a promise. It would be a guarantee. It's hope in a promise that may not be kept of something which is neither present nor absent, but something that haunts us, that disturbs us, that keeps us awake at night, that belongs to what St. Augustine called our cor inquietum, our restless heart, the very opening passage of the Confessions. He says, inquietum est cor nostrum. Our hearts are restless, and they won't rest until they rest in thee. I only quote the first half of that. Our hearts are restless. And I never talk about our hearts resting, because actually I don't think they can, not if they're hearts. To have a heart is to believe in the promise that to come. So this is not, to say perhaps in this other order would not be skepticism, but it would be faith. But this faith would not be belief. Faith exceeds the order of belief and non-belief. Belief and non-belief belong back in the first order, where you believe that something is or you believe that it is not. Atheism and theism belong back in the first order, where something either is or it is not. This is not a belief, but a faith. In French, Derrida says, it's not croyance, from the word credo, creed. It's foi, faith, fides. If you lose your belief, then you switch that for another belief. If an atheist and a theist have a big argument and they convince each other, the theist becomes an atheist, the atheist becomes a theist. Nothing has happened. No event. You can lose your belief and substitute it for another belief or an opposite belief. But to lose faith, the self would collapse. The cor inquietum would fall to the ground. It would stop being. The restlessness would stop, and then there would be peace. And when you have peace, what do we do with you? We bury you. Requiescat in pace, peace, dead. If you lose faith, there's nothing left to do with you but bury you. It's a very different thing than believing in this or that, or not believing. It's much more profoundly affirmative. It's not neutral. It's deeply affirmative. It's deeper than, more radical than, any positive position that you could take. And a positive position is the same word. It's redundant, positive position. It's the same word. Same Latin root. A faith in what's to come runs way deeper than any positive belief or non-belief. It's more open-ended and exposed than a simple negation. It's way more affirmative than a positive position, and it's much more open-ended than a negative position. than a negation. When people deny things, they close down the possibility. So if faced with the name of God, you simply deny it, you close down all that could be going on with that name. Doesn't mean that you need to believe in what some confessional creed calls God, but you close down the operation of the event in that name. You close down its deeper, simmering, restless energy, its elusiveness. I mean, the traditional thing that people say when they're arguing with atheists is you need a very precise and definite and narrow idea of God to deny. Right? So you always need to say that God is way less than God is in order to deny that God exists, because you're trying to establish a negation. So you have to have a very precise and narrow idea. You close down the future of that word. What's really interesting about Derrida and about deconstruction generally and about thinking in the way that we call deconstruction, what's interesting is you don't try to deny something. Derrida's an atheist, right? By the standards of the local rabbi and priest, he's an atheist. But he doesn't deny that God exists. What he does is repeat the name of God differently. Not denial, but repetition. So he writes a book about St. Augustine. He writes, well, that's not true. What he does is he writes a confessions of his own. And instead of making fun of all these things that Augustine says that he doesn't believe, he reinscribes the confessions within his own context. He puts himself in Augustine's shoes and he starts talking to somebody. Te, he says, St. Augustine says, you. The confessions we call an autobiography, but they're really a prayer. We came into the confessions, we staged it up here in Greenbelt, you would find a man on his knees at prayer with his back turned to you. And we would be overhearing this prayer. The text is addressed to you, thee, my God, he says. And so Derrida writes the confessions, which are addressed to you, my God. And we say, Jacques, who are you talking to? You don't believe in God. And he says, I don't know. There are many voices within me. And some of them believe, and some of them don't believe. They give me no rest. Je ne sais pas. He said, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to my mother. Because it was St. Augustine's mother. I'm talking to my colleagues. And to God, even if there's no God. That's how an atheist should treat God. Why? Because it doesn't matter if there's this being called God. This is being recorded, right? Do I get this? It's like, I'm from the United States, and we have a thing called the Nixon tapes. I should be allowed to take some things out of those tapes. So, to say perhaps in this other order is not safe, but very risky. It's not the paralysis of indecision, but it's choosing in the face of something unforeseeable. It's not merely unpredictable or unforeseeable, but it is the weak force of a trembling possibility, which is the possibility of the impossible. If you wanted a good name for God, whether you believe in God or not, you couldn't do better. Well, you probably could, but I can't do better than to say,
the possibility of the impossible. The possibility of the impossible. To say perhaps in this other order is not a failure to achieve certainty and knowledge, but it is a freedom from the rule of the certain, which blocks the future. The preoccupation with certitude blocks the future, prevents the event, perhaps weakens the grip of certitude. It weakens the grip of presence or being, what we were talking about with respect to the first order. It weakens the grip of reality and allows something else to bubble up. You say, well, if it weakens the grip of reality, we have a name for that. You know, we try to give people like that help. Well, it is a kind of madness. It's the madness of the kingdom of God, for one thing. It's the madness for justice. It's the madness for the radical democracy. It's a kind of madness. It's the kind of madness that brings people out into Greenbelt to talk about things like this. There's a madness here. It is mad. But it's not madness over an illusion. The future that I'm talking about is not the future of an illusion, but the future of this unforeseeable, unpredictable to come. And so I like to say, it's not irreal or unreal. When we loosen the grip of reality, the result is not unreality or irreality, but let's say hyper-reality. Something that exceeds what up to now has been possible, which exceeds what up to now has become present. It's beyond it, au-delà, über, hyper, hyper, beyond the real. It's the reality that we're dreaming of. It's not. So this kind of thinking is not anti-realist. It is hyper-realist. It allows the weak force of truth to stay. Now, this kind of thinking often steers clear of the word truth, because the word truth is too strongly associated with the powers that be, the people that think they have the truth. And so a lot of us who work in this area of philosophy spend a lot of time trying to take the hot air out of the word truth, and the people who think they have it. They think they know the truth of gender and the truth of democracy. And what they have is an iron fist around the throat of gender or democracy or whatever. What's stirring, what's to come, is the real truth. So the real truth of a thing is it's becoming true. What is unforeseeably, unpredictably coming true, becoming true in such a way that when it happens, we'll say, that's impossible. It's not irresponsible, this perhaps, in this other order. But the very height of responsibility. Why? Because the best way known to humankind to avoid responsibility is to say, but I was only following the rules, the program, the decision procedure, the creed. When things are programmed, codified, normalized, regularized, regulated, subject to rule, and you follow the rule in the face of a glaring exception, that's the height of irresponsibility. But when you break the rule in the name of something that solicits us from beyond the rule, That's the height of responsibility. Finally, it's not an inability, perhaps, it's not an inability to decide. It is what Keats called a negative capability, by which he meant, I'm sticking to the canvas over there, somebody put glue up, or put bubble gum up here. A negative capability is the capability to sustain an uncertainty. Where to close down, to decide, is to cut off and close down. It maintains uncertainty in the event of something that is promised. We're saying this is not it. We keep the future open. We keep the event alive. Although it's not quite alive, is it? Because it's a ghost. It's spooky. It haunts us. All right. I have, 2 hours? Because that was only the first 10 minutes. All right, well, let's get to God, perhaps. Remember the thesis now. The God of radical theology is a theology of God, perhaps. Where perhaps is taken now in this second order, the ontological order. Then, in that way of thinking, I like to say the name of God is the name of perhaps in that second order. We release God from the order of strong theology. Strong theology is a theology of creed, belief, dogma, confessional identity, institutional structure, history. Now, we can't do without that. Let me say that much. We can't do without that. We can't live with it, and we can't live without it. It has to have a certain viability. It doesn't have to be as awful as it usually is, but it has to have a certain viability. Why? Because we wouldn't so much as remember the name of Jesus without it. There would be no tradition that carried it. The problem with it is that it tends to rigidify. It tends to become too strong. It tends to contract faith into belief, God into the correlate of an assertion that says there is a being called God. It tends to be the leading assertion in a thing called theism. And it usually is made up of an omni-being, with a whole closet full of omni-attributes, like omniscience and omnipotence, who out-knows, outwits us, outpowers us, out-knows, outwits, and outpowers us every time. That's the God of strong theology, confessional theology, which I'm contrasting now with the God of perhaps, which is the God of radical theology. See where I'm going. Breaking the grip of the order of presence, the metaphysical order. Perhaps, remember what, perhaps that's a part of speech. One of the things you should do when you go home from Greenbelt, get your dictionary out and look up the word perhaps. You get to the OED. Because you get a nice big long entry on it. And see all the things it says about the grammar of it as a part of speech and what it does. And among the things that it says that it's an adverb which modifies, interrupts, intercepts, deflects, introduces modalities, degrees, and exceptions. So, radical theology is exactly that with respect to some determinate confessional or strong theology. Interrupts, deflects, intercepts, introduces degrees and modalities and exceptions to what we think God is. God ends up being not a great big noun or a great big, in process philosophy, he becomes a great big process, a great big verb, or a great big he, but a little adverb. In weak theology, God becomes a little adverb. This God will not save us or keep us safe, but rather put us at risk. I like to say, I believe in the God of the gaps, not the God who closes gaps, not the gaps God closes, but the gaps God opens. Because when God, when the name of God, when the event that is harbored in the name of God is set loose on a scene, it disrupts it, turns it upside down, and makes it tremble with the future, with what is possible. The name of God is not the name of a being or a super being in this weak or radical theology. It's the name of the reference to what we are referring to when we call come. The to come haunts us, disturbs us, interrupts us, intercepts us. The to come is on that end, and on this end is the come, the call, what's going on in on our side. On our side, we call come. On the other side, something is coming. Something solicits us. So it's not subjectivistic inside my head. It's highly futural and outside me, ecstatic. Not God Almighty, but the God who might be. If this God were the author or the subject matter of Genesis or of The 3:14 is it's not Genesis 3:14. I'm forgetting where it's called. This God wouldn't say, "I am who am." He would say, he, she, it would say, "I just might be who you think again, think I am, and then again, I just might not be who you think. I just might not be there. I might just be coming and I might not come." Now, if that were true, then the Bible probably wouldn't have sold as many copies as the current version. This God is not a God that would save us. It's a God who would put us at risk, who would make us forsake safety for the unforeseeable and risky promise, which is always a threat. This God would not issue the strong force of a command, but the weak force of perhaps, which would be a call or an invitation, not an imperative. God would not be a source of assurance, but a source of hope that would always be marked by fear. This God would not exist, but would insist. Would not be a super being, but a call. And his name, the name of God would not be a mere name, but would be call for a deed. Would not be weak, but would be strong. The perhaps would infiltrate everything about this call that the name of God harbors. That's why Derrida could be an atheist and write about the name of God, because something is getting itself called or hoped for in that name. Something's calling, but we don't know who. Maybe it's just our biology. Maybe it's our DNA. Maybe it's our history. Maybe it's our unconscious. We don't know. Something's calling, but the author of the call is structurally unknown. Maybe the call will go unanswered, unheeded. One of the things that you can do with a call or an invitation is ignore it. And maybe, perhaps, if the call is answered, the result will be a disaster. Nobody is guaranteeing anything. So, I leave you with a prayer to this God, who may be. Prayer comes from the Latin word from which we get the word precarious, precor, precarious. Prayer is for people who are hanging on by their teeth in a precarious position, hanging on by the grace of an event. Because we don't know to whom we pray, or whether there is anyone to pray to, or what we really are praying for, which is why you are warned again and again, be careful what you pray for. You may get it. And we don't know whether our prayers will be answered or whether the answer won't be a disaster. Radical theology, therefore, is theology, perhaps, because if you're a theologian, if perchance, perhaps, there's a theologian in the audience, you should have gotten up and left a while ago. Because this is not theology, perhaps. If it were, I wouldn't have anything to do with it. The only kind of theology that I'm interested in is a theology on the very edge. The theology which is practically not theology, which doesn't look like theology anymore. It's only under the condition that this might not be theology that I would do theology. Okay, final quote back to Jacques Derrida again. Here's what he says. Here's the truth. What is going to come? Perhaps, is not only this or that, it is at last the thought of the perhaps itself. What's coming could perhaps be the perhaps itself, the unheard of, totally new experience of the perhaps. Unheard of, totally new, that very experience which no philosopher might yet have dared to think. Thank you very much. Catherine, that's right. Catherine Ceramudi is doing something at 7:30 that we have to get to the next step of, and she will be there. I guarantee it.